There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's Community News Program, Off the Hour. Today is Friday, July 1st. My name is Brian Jefferson, and I'll be your host today. CKUT broadcasts from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg and the Kanyankahaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Stay tuned, we'll be right back. But first, some news. Today is July 1st, Quebec's traditional moving day, raising concerns about the rising rent prices. Thousands of people have called the City of Montreal for housing assistance since January. That is triple the number from the time period since 2020. And on Thursday, dozens gathered outside McGill University's Schulich School of Music to protest the administration's decision to close the McGill Conservatory of Music. It's run by Schulich and has offered private music lessons to McGill students and the Montreal community since 1904. McGill says that the decision was necessary due to the increasing operational costs. And thousands of Air Canada passengers in Montreal are experiencing major flight delays, cancelled flights, and/or lost luggage. This is due to a labor shortage in the travel industry. Air Canada announced they will be cancelling more flights throughout the summer. And the Université Laval Faculty Union filed a grievance report over Professor Patrick Provost's suspension, saying that it threatened academic freedom. Provost is a microRNA researcher and claimed that the risks of vaccinating children against COVID-19 outweighs the benefits. And today is Canada Day. Montreal's free celebrations began at 1 p.m. in the Old Port with a gun salute. Other cities across Canada are reworking their traditional celebrations to acknowledge the country's oppressive treatment of Indigenous people.
We Groove Records and QCJA Productions presents Uptown Reggae Night, Uptown Reggae Sunday, Night. July 3rd at La Belle Mall, featuring for Toronto 12-time Juno nominee Blessed and Montreal's own Sabu, backed by the Gaia Band. Special guest, Kayla Allen, and music by DJ Big Worm. Doors open 8 p.m., show starts 9 p.m. Uptown Reggae Night, Sunday, July 3rd at La Belle Mall, 4483 St. Laurent Boulevard. Advanced tickets, $20 available at Eventbrite and select locations across town. This is a CKUT co-presentation. Come listen to some reggae music.
And now, for some international headlines. On Thursday, the U.S. Supreme Court limited the Environmental Protection Agency's ability to control greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. The Biden administration is now drafting new regulation on climate change. And Sudanese police officers fired on protesters, killing 8 people across Khartoum and its twin cities. Huge masses have taken to the streets demanding civilian rule and justice for people killed in a violent crackdown in 2019. And overnight, Russian missile strikes on the southern Odessa region of Ukraine killed at least 20, including one child. According to Ukraine's State Emergency Agency, 16 people were killed when a single missile struck a 9-story building in the settlement of Syrivka. A separate attack on a village vacation resort resulted in the deaths of 4 more people.
Tree Canada's National Greening Program is planting seedlings across 5 regions of the country: BC, the Prairies, Ontario, Quebec, and the Atlantic. They plant in areas that are in need of reforestation or afforestation across Canada. Tree Canada selects sites where appropriate native species will be planted to make sure that natural forests come back to life. To learn more or to get involved, go to treecanada.ca.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to CKUT's Friday Off the Hour. The time is just after 5 p.m. My name is Brian Jefferson, and up first on this episode of Off the Hour, we'll be listening to an episode of From Embers podcast. It's called Solidarity with the People of Ukraine, and it's about the political and historical context of Russia's invasion.
You are listening to From Embers, a weekly show on CFRC 101.9 FM about anarchist and anti-authoritarian ideas and practice. We are broadcasting from the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples on land that has come to be called Kingston, Ontario, Canada because of the thievery and brutality of the Canadian state and its empire-loving parents. From Embers is about fires, some real and some metaphorical. Fires started generations ago and tended to over the years. Little sparks all across this territory that we hope will grow, spread, and engulf the thieving state called Canada and the capitalist system that has plagued this land since the fur trade.
Tonight on From Embers, you'll hear my conversation with the author of a piece entitled Addressing Russian Propaganda, which you can find online at Perleski.org. That's P-R-A-L-E-S-K-I.org. This interview focuses more on some of the political background of what's going on with the Russian state and really urges people to consider the need to support people in Ukraine fighting off Russian invasion. Our conversation was recorded a few weeks ago now on March 29th, so my apologies for any details which are now out of date. I guess could you start by introducing yourself however you would like, or describing a bit in terms of your context, your surroundings, where you are, and...
I grew up in Russia. Like, I'm Russian. That's the first very important point, I guess, for this kind of interview right now. And so I left when I was a student, actually, like on the university. I mean, student in English, how it is, like university times. And then I kept the contact, and I was into, like, how to call it now, like anti-authoritarian anarchist, whatever, scene. And was living in the West, going to the West is like, well, what is the West for you in Canada? It might be a bit different to understand how Europe is, how people read it. So it's like, let's say everything from Poland to the West is West, and kind of that.
Sure,
so let's say so Western Europe, let's say. But then, about 10 years ago, like a bit less, I was actually, down with it. And I spent most of my time going around, like doing like different stuff, like, in Eastern Europe, like generalizing it this way.
In the context of this, of the recent, Russian military invasion of Ukraine, can you describe maybe what's going on either for you personally or people in your broader social networks?
When this war started, like in the first stage, was a big shock, I guess, for most of my environment as well, because I guess we didn't expect it on such scale, how it came, like so openly, so big, and like a big one. And I guess it's also the privilege of like, people like me who grew up without war and was actually only seeing it from some distance, you know, and or maybe also like some psychological stuff about like not wanting to believe in some things, or like not realizing it, like not being well prepared. It's like some, it sounds for you like quite crazy, even if you try to think about it. So, and Yeah, I guess it was like also like a huge mobilization, let's say, that over last year wasn't part of any like well-organized groups or something. Let's say I'm a bit elder, I was like, have a lot of frustrations with that, and was living like personal life, let's say, with some, yeah, some connections to old friends. But, and then, yeah, it's coming and you're like, wow, shit happens. Like, it hits the fan, people in your say, I guess, in a way. So you need to do something. I mean, I was in Kiev actually just a week before the war started, by like some personal means. And so I just left before, and yeah, we was like joking about, yeah, not like quite sad jokes about like, yeah, the troops are closing, but yeah, they're for real still thinking that, yeah, it will be some other like kind of escalation on like more the level of I don't know, saying like some media, whatever, like some threats, but not really that the bombs will start falling just like just right after I left. So and that it will change the life like so crucial.
Can you describe a bit your context, like in terms of living under like the Russian state, so to speak, or its influence, or like Russia as like a military or colonial power, and sort of the like authoritarian regime that's currently in power?
Yeah, it's an interesting point because, you know, I grew up in the 90s where all this like authoritarian tendencies wasn't very much like visible for us. Like, I mean, grew up even like my teenage years and like early like 90s or 2000s. So just like I kind of seen it changing so much because let's say like in 90s and at school, I didn't get like even like state flag or like president was just alcoholics who was like Yeltsin. You may, I don't know if you know, but it's like a guy who nobody would like anyhow like respect or something. It's like it was just nothing real. Like people would watch like parliamentary shows from like TV and stuff like as a comedy or something. And yeah, it was very turbulent times in many ways, but generally spoken like ideologically from above, it was not really so much of a pressure. At least I haven't felt that. And then Putin came at power with a Chechen war, like second Chechen war they started, and like all this like what US got like with the how it is like 9/11, yeah. So in Russia it was also like this terrorist attacks which have like very unclear nature. As for now, it's like some theories, very solid theories behind that actually the Secret Service was very much involved into organizing it. But whatever, it's it was like a mass mobilization against people in Chechnya, and a lot of like racist narratives and all this stuff. With now we have a new strong leadership, I guess. Back then was very young, like not really still understanding what is going on, and I guess the topic of this like colonial nature in a way, like maybe people wasn't, I cannot remember if people was using this word so much. I don't think so, to be honest, but generally like this agenda was kind of there. So also like in anarchist anti-authoritarian milieus, what was not really the case later, like 10 years later, maybe like late 2000s, it was not that much anywhere anymore there. So, and yeah, I don't know. It's like, you know, like this question, you should kind of compare it to something. Yeah. Because my main point is not that there is like authoritarian regime from above, which is like enslaving people and making them some, I don't know, cruel monsters, but maybe in a way vice versa, that the people have something like in a society in Russia have something in it that makes exactly such a regime more suitable for. So I don't mean, of course, like bullshit about like genetics and stuff, please don't misunderstand it this way. I mean, of course, like some like historical narratives and what we was learning at school. Like later I was realizing it more and more that even in this yeah being like Russian wood and being like growing up there, what it actually brings. And I guess this immigration experience was a big deal to see how things changing from a side, like coming and going to visiting your family and friends and seeing like how things are changing. What was not maybe so much visible for people inside. So because you kind of hear, like, don't see it so much, so well, like from the close distance sometimes, I guess. And so, yeah. And yeah, it changed like very much, like just in practical way that, let's say like mid-2000s and 2000s, like political actions. Sure, it was like quite some violence from the police, but generally spoken, political persecution in terms of like long-term sentences and stuff wasn't really there. So you would, I mean, I got like only a little bit of that, but the things that was like sentenced for, I don't know, $20, yeah, like US dollars. Now you can go for like several years in jail, you know, for the same. So it's kind of a big change, like of style, yeah. And I guess it's not that all the repressions and they was there. They was just not against people in Metropole maybe so much, you know. I guess on the periphery it was definitely there. I mean, war was going on and a lot of praxis which people, like which police and not only political police, but usual police is using against people in jail or like in police stations, all this torture. They're not like falling from the sky. They was learning it in like war regions. They was learning it. They was torturing, I don't know, some Chechen people there. So then they was doing the same with like, how to explain, for proclaimed criminals or whatever, like, you know, people they outside of this region. So it was like kind of, it's very well described in some like literature on colonialism, you know, how it's like this kind of colonial boomerang, they call it, is it the word boomerang in English, right? Yeah, I'm not really sure. So so yeah, I guess this kind of change of regime was going on with time, and maybe after 2012 or some 2012, like, yeah, around that, after like this Bolotnaya case and stuff, it's like kind of crystallized more. And with Crimea, like annexation and war with Ukraine 2014 and like a military invasion there, it was also like this mass mobilization which like was also showing that the ideology which was developed created, like recreated, like in 2000s, that it became more of like actual thing of the state. Because I guess when Putin came at power and was like starting to change, like him personally, team, whatever, how you call it, like they was changing the political life, like in the country, like how it's organized, like centralizing it, like gaining more power and eliminating enemies and like changing political field. I don't think they was so much into ideology, actually. They was like trying different ones. I mean, 2004, there was like a first Maidan movement in Ukraine and the government changed. So they in Russia like really got fear that it might change their positions too. And I guess this generation of old people from security service and so on, they really didn't got like a well education in social sciences and their understanding of societies around them and their own society is very rigid, like very simplistic, and I guess they really believe in like this conspiracy theories and stuff, like that somebody from above is like influencing people, and so they need to be in control somehow. So they started to try to control like the streets in some way, like creating some political parties, and I guess it wasn't like intentionally that they created this thing, like created, adopted this like red brown stuff, like this mixture of like Stalinism and old even like monarchism, let's say, and like right-wing elements. I guess it was more of like trial and error, that it just worked better. And also that the people they got to work for them was like mostly good in that and coming mostly from that corner. So it's why I guess it's changed in this way.
I wanted to ask you to describe sort of the idea of anti-fascism in Russia, or how that is sort of used by the state, or even sort of like also the presence of more like apolitical anti-fascism that's not necessarily like a anti-authoritarian or like resistance thing, but more like a narrative used to justify and motivate the Putin regime's forces, I guess. Like, yeah, I wanted to ask you to talk about or describe fascism and the idea of anti-fascism in the context of Russia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, what is maybe hard to understand that it's like state ideology, first of all, that the relation to the Second World War and particular how people call it, it's like Great Fatherland War in Russia. It's maybe the main historical narrative at all. So, you know, in 90s, not in only 90s actually, but in 90s it was very visible that the state and like similar institutions, they was like desperately looking for like some tradition they can appeal to, you know, and like maybe to mobilize people and stuff. And the story of the Second World War was quite well suited for, because it gave the opportunity to mobilize people without any appeal to any values or something, you know, because it's absolutely empty. It's like the main thing is like to oppose the invaders, you know, the idea of the war, Second World War, or like it's seen more in the tradition of invasion, like mostly Western invasion. It started in 30s already, like late 30s, and maybe like during the Second World War it was like crystallized more like in Stalin times. So that actually the Russian state like was always attacked, like some invaders was coming like from Teutons, it's like German kind of thing, like in 13th century, and then Alexander Nevsky was like fighting that, or like Polish people was like taking Moscow in beginning of 17th century and then was fought back, or like Napoleon was coming. And actually war with Napoleon, like it was like the first Fatherland War, like just the Fatherland War, you know, the Second World War is a Great Fatherland War, war with Napoleon is a usual like Fatherland War. It was also one of the main narratives in 19th century, and it was also times when the Russian nation was built, let's say, like when it was like fulfilled, like finished, or like if you can say at all that this process is finishing anytime in history. So the main narratives was like that the invaders are coming, the invaders like facing not just like some political group or like some particular party in the government or something, but they're facing like the whole Russian nation, like the whole Russian like people, you know. So the people are uniting around some idea, or like some idea of like land or something, and fighting back and then destroy this threat, yeah. And so for the Second World War, for the Great Fatherland War, it's crystallized in the idea that the invaders are like essential threat, not only for Russia, but like for the whole world. Yeah, it's like Nazism, like Nazis, yeah, German Nazis. They're like the big threat without any idea actually what exactly is the threat, you know? It's just like they're just evil, yeah? They just want to destroy everything you love, whatever. But what exactly, it's like not clear. They're just coming and destroying. So we have to be united, and united in around the leader in the end, you know, like how it was like in Stalinism, or, you know, like around the leader, or around at least like the leading party or the state, the idea of state. So because historically seen, like Second World War in territories of ex-Soviet Union now, It was like such a multitude of different like armed groups, partisans, and then like some different forces of like state, nationless, this, that, collaborants, and so on. And the narrative, which is actually shared by the society, is that there's like only two sides. Yeah, Nazi Germany and the good guys. So ours, like Red Army, or like however people call it. So, and in this like worldview, anti-fascism is not anyhow connected to any like values. You know, it's like actually not really clear like how you distinguish between fascist and not fascist. It's just an enemy. It's just like just everything evil. You know, like being fascist, because like in Soviet Union and later in Russia, like this theories of what is fascism and stuff, like, wasn't really developed. So. And so this kind of way of seeing that makes it very easy to feel this story with whatever particular groups, you know. And so it's more about symbolic, maybe, you know, like what is easier to see. Yeah, if somebody have a like swastika, it's a fascist. If not, if like red star or something, that's anti-fascist or something like that. And then even more that Russian is like per se essentially anti-fascist, yeah, and everybody who is against Russians is a fascist then, yeah. And already before the Second World War and then during and after, the central government of Russia like adopted like this kind of Russian chauvinism, or like how you would call it back then, like playing with that and like playing using. So, and there was also resistance to it, yeah. So there was like occupied territories, like the new ones in the West, for example, not only in the West, but also there. So there was like mass ethnical like deportations, which was amount of casualties, or like amount of like people dying during that. You can call cleansings, or like how you call it, like ethnical cleansings or something. Yeah. So repressions, let's say. So yeah, the central state narratives was calling these people who was opposing it also like fascists, yeah, and then was using this idea of like Nazi collaborators, because at some point like Nazis was using some nationalist forces as a collaborator units during the war. Like, I mean, interesting point about that, it's like the Russians was actually the biggest one, like if you would see like the amount of like how big this units was, yeah, but nobody's talking about that. People only talking about like so-called like traitors, you know, traitor nations, like they call it like completely like traitor nations, and these are like the most unloyal ones in the end, yeah, like people who was not loyal enough and was resisting, yeah. It's like the whole like periphery mostly of Soviet Union is full of such stories, yeah, like how the central government was oppressing the resistance and like repressing people. So this and this repressions would be calling like the anti-fascist one in the end, you know.
Красную дорогу.
You're listening to From Embers, airing first on CFRC 101.9 FM.
We're also a proud member of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. We'll get right back to my interview with a guest speaking about the Russian invasion of Ukraine. But first, here's a jingle from another Channel Zero show.
Listening to Dissident Island Radio.
Live every first and third Friday of the month at 9 p.m. GMT.
Check out www.dissidentisland.org for downloads and more.
And also, like this, particularly like this propaganda about traitors, not just the people as traitors, but like collective guilt of several nations. Like, for example, how it was like with Ukrainians and like their movements, yeah, which is now Russia is like calling to it a lot. It's like that the figure of Ukrainian as such, like during like, 19th century and even before, already was connected with the idea of threat, like in the Russian nationalism, like on the very early stages. A bit like simplistic and speculative, yeah, to say when Russian nation was built, like modernization came like in the 18th century with Peter the Great and later, like started maybe even before. There are like different ways to define your own nation, yeah, through the othering. It's like very familiar, like you have like others, yeah, let's say like people who are not white, who have like other race, or like who are definitely like others, yeah. It's like for Russia it would be like people in Central Asia, native people, or like people from Caucasus and so on. But with other Slavic folks, yeah, like Belarus or Ukraine, it's different. So it's not like they are not others. They Russians refuse the right to exist to them. So it's like the way of like they would be like kind of somehow broken Russians, you know, somehow polluted by the West or something, yeah. So like something invented and so traitors, yeah. So that they was like polluted by the West and they are not willing to be Russians, yeah. They kind of sin and they treat is that they not accepting. Not just the rule of Russian like Tsar or like central government, but they are not thankful enough that just to dissolve in the body of the Russian nation. Yeah. So yeah. In this way, it's like even to declare I'm Ukrainian, I'm from Belarus, it's already a threat. Yeah. It's already something which cannot happen. And it's a, why now Russia is like what they call it Nazism now, yeah? It's actually the very idea of independence, the very idea of being not loyal to the central government is actually fascism for them, you know? Of course, they are also using like this facts of collaboration history of some like groups during the Second World War. It's like easy to find. You can find like everybody there, you know? It's like Russians, whoever. So it's not a big deal to do. So, but the way is like what you will highlight and how you will use it in a modern propaganda. That's the point, yeah. So, and then it's like a big denial of even like existence of Ukraine. They're saying Ukraine was created by Lenin or Ukraine was created by Austrian-Hungarian bureaucrats or whatever. You know, they will just. Not even like kind of see it as an enemy. They will see it like as a puppet of the West or something, you know? It's like there is no such thing, you know, as Ukrainian. And so the idea of this denazification for Putin now, it's like they see it as liberation, you know, from how it is like Yoko, like from the foreign rule or something, yeah, that people should be like very thankful for, you know, that you kind of make them good again. You know, they was like suffering under, I don't know, Western rule or something, and now Russians will come and will liberate them. You know, that's the idea of like how this propaganda ideologically works, you know, like what they're trying to sell.
Yeah, I totally understand, like, how that would be awful and bad to be experiencing as someone who lives in Ukraine and sees, like, a necessity to fight against the Russian invasion. What, like, do you see a position or a way to do that or to support that that doesn't depend on supporting the Ukrainian state or participating in a specifically Ukrainian nationalism? Like, is there another sort of way that people can think about that struggle? And does that, is that a current that exists on the ground that you know of also?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is right now that it's not such, there is no such a luxury of like choosing between like ideologically right or not so much, like, you know, like what do you like so much. It's like, it's a question of survival. So I'm not in a position to judge people for whatever so choices. And I don't see like my position is like people first should survive, and I want to support them in that. And then we'll be like seeing like, well, what is going on, you know? And so I guess what is like with anarchists, it's like an anarchist myself, you know, it's like the thing is like that, yeah, don't support the state. Okay, like how far you will go with not supporting the state? Yeah, it's always the question. Yeah, we are like using, I don't know, like I don't know, water supply like in my house is like built by the state. You know, I mean, this house not, but like whatever. Like how far you will go? Yeah, of supporting, not supporting the state. What is more interesting for you? Being like having like puristic view on to show off among your like small circle, or like literally like achieving something, yeah. So and like achieving something in a like in a way of like how society is changing, or like what kind of like or like not changing, or like maybe just surviving in a way, yeah. Like we have now the situation where you have like Russia, which is like politically a black hole. There is like nothing there. It's like everything which reach this like gravity disappears. That's it. Like you could see it like when we're coming back to Ukraine, like when Crimea was annexed, people who was politically active needed to escape. That's only the option. I mean, barely, yeah. It's like at least to say that's not comparable how much you can do in Ukraine, like this kind of like more like bourgeois democracy, whatever society, how you call it, or like in Russia, which is like getting more and more authoritarian, and now you might call it fascist. So there is definitely a difference for opportunities in these different societies. So, and now it's connected to extinction. It's connected to the fact that Russian army is now using the tactics, which means like completely destroying, like not just like ideologically something, no, just fucking like people, like really literally like bombing people away, like completely like the cities, the houses, the like killing like thousands and ten thousands of people, you know, it doesn't matter whom. It's a part of the tactics, like military tactics. So the ideology behind it is quite scary. I mean, they was first talking about denazification of like some political parties or whatever. Now they like maybe about a week, 2 weeks ago, like not only some like radicals from internet, but like people on the like state TV and so on, they started to talk about, look, Ukrainians are refusing to accept our rule. They're strange. It looks like that all of them are Nazis. So, and what they are doing now, for example, with people who they kidnap, or I don't know how, maybe like let them go, like from Mariupol to Russia, they kind of starting like this how it is in English correct, called like filtration camps, you know, concentration camps, where they denazificate these people first and then deport them somewhere deep in Russia. Or like, it's not really, we don't have like that much facts to describe it very well, but it's definitely something. I don't like these big words usually, but it's a fucking genocide, like what is going on. And then, you know, and then now talking about like to support this or to support that, it's like great actually if we would have this opportunity so well. And there are initiatives who are like more horizontal, and actually the most initiatives, like Ukrainian state is not that strong to organize everything. It was not in any sense, not in sense of military, not in sense of bureaucracy and so on. So it is it does rely on like self-organized initiatives as well. So and there is not just like a vertical top-down organizing there. Yeah, the most of things, I mean, like our comrades now and like friends, how they organize, it's like horizontal from people to people, you know. And in this way there are like plenty of opportunities to support. Yeah, so and also, yeah, maybe not everybody's waving like circularly, yeah, but what is happening, I would call it very close to what anarchists call like anarchism in terms of organizing and like real on the ground, yeah, like mutual aid. I mean, what is going on? A lot. So, and the thing about like nationalism and like nationalist mobilizations and stuff, so you cannot avoid to have it like in a war and in our century. So in this time, so I don't think I'm the right person to to question too much about, you know. I don't see myself in the position, like, you know, to judge and to make like some fancy analysis on that right now. I guess we should ask people in Ukraine about.
Sure. Yeah.
I guess I can speak for Russia, and I can talk more about like Russia. What the fuck is that? I'm sorry for language.
I mean, so. I'm glad. I think that's an important perspective to share, honestly, because it's, you know, speaking to people in the West who are like living under Western imperialism and NATO, et cetera, et cetera. It's like it is a choice in a sense of like, oh, how do you want to talk about this struggle, or how do you want to support it or encourage other people to support it? And, you know, I mean, I personally do think that people who are suffering under this invasion and or suffering under living under this regime deserve our support, like, you know, just ordinary people. They're not it's not the state or something. And it, what am I trying to say? Yeah, it's just that like I think critical solidarity is important, but I think it's, I agree that it's sometimes like easier to fall back into sort of purist apathy or something, and I don't think that's good.
No, sure. So I mean, it's a very comfortable position, you know, like to be so like judgy. And then the problem of this position is that people are following sometimes like just somebody who is like who is just presenting what people want to see, you know, like I don't know if I'm clear. So it's like you want somebody who is waving circle A, people will wave circle A. Yeah.
So, yeah, for sure.
I don't know if there are like doubts of supporting and help people in Ukraine. I don't know how to talk like forward, like to touch people, like doubts in terms of like really okay, just die, because I'm not really completely sure if I will support your initiatives of buying like some medical supply, or like I don't know, like collecting money for another car to drive like refugees from the border. Maybe it will somehow support the nationalism. So just fuck off. I mean, what we are talking about, you know? Like really, in this case, I just don't know. This kind of discussions are like disgusting. I guess there are times for discussions. There are times for when it's maybe too late. I mean, it's more about people with my background, even I'm not living in Russia for ages, still I have like some responsibility for what happened. Like, I mean, yeah, it was like, I told you, like, and you actually know that I'm not just wasn't supporting the state, but I tried to do something like against this ideology, like propaganda and stuff, but not enough. So it's absolutely clear. And that's also the point now. So that it's a point to think about that. Like, well, what actually was a fail? Like, what was it? What should be done, like, and what we can done now, do now. So, and I guess, so yeah. And the part of this dynamics of looking from the center to the periphery in this very colonial way of like judging people, like in a way of like using the frames you created yourself for them. So, and then just like picking the positions or like picking something which suits your own analysis, like in the center, like just to feed up your own, theories or like everyday just subcultural like attitudes, life, you know, to just using like some references, how it happens like with solidarity movements a lot. I don't know if you understand what I mean. So,
I think so.
Yeah, so I guess people will understand. So that's definitely not solidarity, I wouldn't call it solidarity, to be honest. Something else, sure, but... And it doesn't mean that people are evil doing that. I mean, the intentions are great, and the problem is, like, the ways it's canalizing, like, maybe even some empathy and some, like, willing to make something good. It's like... So, yeah. And, yeah, critical solidarity, sure, absolutely. But to have, like, critical solidarity, first you need to have a very good connections to people, and it's not something you create, like, just in a few seconds, you know? Like, it's not that you're just calling the hotline of, like, help, and then, like, yeah, you help. No, it's like you need to have the context between movements, like, solidarity ones, for sure. So, but, yeah. So it's actually maybe the point as well. To do so, especially yeah. Right now, it's like to reduce people in Ukraine to some victims. It's absolutely bullshit. Like people showing such a like the will and to resist and to like to like we should learn. I mean, it's not something like that. Some cool guy somewhere in the West would be like. Now like teaching people no come on, just take a look, like some I don't know, some peasant villagers from Ukraine will maybe teach you something, like me too. So how to self-organize, like, well, you know, under these circumstances, I guess it's like the approach should be a bit different. So
what would you hope to see in that regard, or like in terms of people either offering meaningful support or trying to build connections with people and movements, what do you think would help people do that?
Yeah, I mean, right now it's maybe not a good time for big discussions with people on the ground. Yeah, it's like something, yeah, people are, let's say, busy. Yeah. So I guess it's clear. So, but to establish like connections and support, that's I guess it's right now it's quite easy. It's just like people need resources, people need some. Yeah, resources in the first line. I mean, there are some initiatives you might be linking later. So it's actually quite a lot. You could see like in Europe, for example, how people organize helping refugees, or like people organizing like to deliver some like material resources, not just money, but also like some stuff which is now complicated to get, like in Ukraine itself, and like delivering it, and like people going there to do stuff as well. So it's like, I don't know, maybe It's somehow it's so obvious, and somehow maybe yeah, so much questions are rising still. I don't know. Maybe you should be more precise. But...
That makes sense. Because yeah, in a sense, it is kind of obvious. But I guess I feel motivated by like sort of identifying the obstacles to people doing that. Like, which I think one of them is this sort of like kind of purist attitude. But maybe that's not the only obstacle. I think maybe also sometimes another obstacle is like, which you kind of spoke about earlier, is like some of the confusion around like who is a fascist and who is like not a fascist and what is, you know, like people have this like, I think it comes from a good place, like this like strong desire to not help far right or fascist movements grow because it means a lot of violence and misery for many, many people in the world. Like, I respect that. But I think there is a lot of like confusion and disinformation and stuff about different actors in these conflicts. So even, you know, talking about that like state narrative of anti-fascism mm-hmm. and whatever is like, I think helpful.
I guess it's like this identity politics is just like not really helpful. It's because, you know, if somebody calls themselves anti-fascist or fascist, even sometimes, like, I mean, fascist is maybe less fashionable word right now, but it doesn't really mean anything. It's just a word, guys. I mean, first, clarify for yourself, what do you mean with anti-fascism? What exactly do you mean? Or like fascism? So when you clarify it for yourself, what you exactly you mean to for the fascism, you know, like with fascism, what is that? What are like particularly, like, what is that? Like, if you have, I don't know, racist attitude, it's clearly more clear, yeah? Or like homophobia, it's like more clear. Okay, somebody's homophobic, like, okay, I don't want to work with them. All right, or not all right. So, you know, more precise. And then if you have it like for yourself, then maybe you will be checking it better. Like, you know, how many fascists you need in a group to consider it a fascist group, you know, like, is it like, sure. If in the army of, I don't know, Canada, like, let's say like a cell or like in the police, like, yeah, like three Nazis, is the whole police or like whole unit Nazi or not, you know? And so on, you know, just like be more precise for yourself, maybe, you know, and be like more consequent with this like judgments, you know. I guess the big problem is that people don't know themselves what they mean, and anarchists, this ones, leftists, whatever, what exactly do you mean, like for yourself, first of all, you know, then you, it maybe will be more clear, like on the other side of the globe, you know, what do you mean, because then don't follow the symbols like that much, don't follow the words. Which might mean something completely different. It's exactly the point with Russia. It was like very visible after 2014 when, like, in Western Europe, like all these groups.
Welcome back to Off the Hour on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are just listening to an episode of From Embers podcast. If you want to hear the rest, head to FromEmbersLibsyn.com and look for the third episode from the top. And before we go, we'll leave you with some news that you can use. Free Canada Day celebrations are ongoing in the Old Port. At Car St. Pierre, there's face painting and games, as well as a live concert at 8 p.m. Then you can catch the Canada Day fireworks show starting at 9:45 p.m. For more information, search up Canada Day Old Port Montreal. And for ways to show Indigenous solidarity today and the rest of the year, you can visit Mobilizing for MP Instagram page. And today, July 1st, is moving day in Montreal, but struggles with affordable housing will continue past today. If you or somebody you know needs help, you can look up the nonprofit FRAPU. It stands for Front d'Action Populaire and Aménagement Urbain, and their website is frapru.qc.ca. You can also call the City of Montreal for help at 311. That's 311. and the Montreal Art Festival is here, St. Catherine Street will be an open-air art gallery until July 3rd. The festival also includes interactive performances and activities. For more information, visit mtlonarts.com. And Carrie Festa is back on July 2nd from noon to 4 p.m. This colorful Caribbean parade will include band performances, costumes, and parade floats. For more information, visit the Carrie Festa of Montreal, that's CARIFESTA, Facebook page. And the Open Door Shelter is looking for clothing donations, which you can drop off at 3535 Park Avenue. For more information, visit the Mobilizing for MP Instagram page. And that concludes this Friday's edition of Off the Hour, produced by Montreal's Community News Collective. The collective includes Brian Jefferson, Alice Wu, Joel Salmadal, Killian Davenport Brown, Tess Pilkington, Pranjal Malik, Moisha Mori, Reem Araji, Michael Edelson, and Sarah Jesmer. For more information on anything you heard tonight, or if you would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 2593, or email newsintern at ckut.ca. Also, you can follow us on Instagram at OffTheHourMTL, or connect with us on Facebook, search CKUT. Stay tuned for Cafe coming up next, right here on 90.3 FM.
Or ckut.ca on the web. This is the special Perversité edition of our show. It is Monday, August 10th. About 25 years ago, on July 16th, 1990, a mostly queer after-hours party called Sex Garage, which was held in the Old Port of Montreal, was raided by police. The raid involved intense and homophobic police violence and a number of arrests. The reaction to these raids, which included a kiss-in and a number of protests and demonstrations, would lead to a new relationship between queer people and the public, as well as the formation of the now no longer existent DVRCT, Montreal's first LGBTQ...